Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Darlitz.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy. My name is Matthew Darlitz, Editor-in-Chief of the Science of Psychotherapy, and as always here with Managing Editor and good mate Richard Hill. Howdy, Richard.
Howdy, Matt. I am here, and the weather is cooling down for us in sunny Australia, so I've actually got to have a jacket. I'm not wearing it now because I'm in the office, and you are wearing a jacket. Welcome, everybody, and what a wonderful day we're going to have today. Who are we talking to? Tell me.
Yeah, so we're going across to the United States once again. We're going to talk to Dr. Michael Yapko.
I knew we were going to talk to Michael Yapko. Yes, I do. I knew, but I was sounding sort of coy. It's so good. Michael is such a great mate and such a great supporter, actually, of my progress through therapeutic life over the years. And he has, unsurprisingly, written another fabulous book.
So he's a clinical psychologist in Southern California. He's the author of Mindfulness and Hypnosis and his other book, Trance Work, which is, I think, five editions or something, been an enormous big seller for him. And he is just an internationally recognized masterful person in the world of hypnosis.
Yeah, I think masterful is just the best word. And his work on depression and the way, I mean, he speaks to hypnosis audiences, sure, but he also speaks to psychological, the psychiatric, psychotherapeutic, counseling. So he's a wonderful broad speaker. And I think we should just let him speak for himself about this fabulous new book.
Now, just before we jump across to Michael Yapko, I'd just like to let the listeners know that this episode is being sponsored by BetterHelp.
Yes, these great guys at BetterHelp, they do fabulous work with putting therapists and clients together online. Why we're excited about the review, I mean, it's great for the work they do, but we've organised that everybody who finds it a great idea to join their team as a therapist, they will get a free one-year subscription. And if you're already a subscriber, you'll get an extension of 1 year. So although we're excited about the work they do, we're very excited about giving away the being able to extend our subscriptions. But what it is that it's a place where you can increase your clients, particularly if you've had some fall away of clients with the pandemic of late. And also for those of you who want to sort of test out the online and get some work in on the online without going to all the expense, they will bring you the clients, they will bring you the technology, they will bring you all those aspects. And you simply have to look after clients and accept the fee as it comes in. So it's as simple as that. And you get this 1 year of us absolutely free.
Fantastic. So if you want some more details, we'll leave a link in the show notes. Now, across to Michael Yapko. Dr. Michael Yapko, welcome once again to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast.
Thanks so much, Matthew. Appreciate it. Good to talk to you, Richard.
Fantastic to see you again. Yes, it's really good. We've missed your getting a good hug, but not to worry. We'll do that sometime in the next decade or two.
We really hope to be back in Sydney early next year if travel is possible.
Yeah, well, definitely we'll have some dinner. Be great. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Today we're going for a walk in the forest. I understand.
Okay.
Yeah, no, your fabulous new book just come out, Norton. Process-Oriented Hypnosis. Focus on the forest, not the trees. Now, there's some wonderful insights in there that we can go through. So, a new book, Michael. What have you got? Nothing else to do. It's fantastic the way you put these wonderful things out.
Well, thank you. It's book number 16, and if I have any common sense at all, it'll be the last one. But we'll see. The COVID pandemic, being quarantined at home, gave me the opportunity to finish up on a number of projects that I'd been hoping to get to eventually, but wasn't getting to because of all the other things that I was doing. So the fact that I had the time and the fact that so much of it was already written, you know, bits and pieces I'd been doing all along, that just seemed like a good time to finish it up and get it out there.
Get it on out there. I think one of the things that grabbed my eye I mean, just in the very, very early stages, looking at the comments from other people in the industry, was Steve Langton's comment going through, everybody thinks it's fabulous. I mean, I've looked at it, I think it's fabulous too, of course. But he says, a must read for all therapists. And I know you've got hypnosis in the title, but this is something Ernie was also very big on, that it's not this restrictive thing. And I understand that it's been selling really well, but it's been recognized at Amazon as a really good hypnosis book, but also in psychotherapy. What are your thoughts about that type of comment?
Well, I really had intended for it to be the hypnosis focus, but the reality is it is about therapy in general, you know, that it addresses the fundamental question of how people generate the symptoms that they generate, whatever they are. And far less emphasis on speculating why people have the problems that they have and much more on how they generate it. And so that does directly apply to psychotherapy, because whether you do hypnosis or not, it would certainly be valuable to have a deeper understanding of how this person generates the problems that they experience, without getting lost in the details of the problem or without getting lost in some theoretical perspective that might be of interest to you but is of very little interest to your client, because all they want is to feel better.
Now, this aspect of getting lost because you're focused on the detail of the narrative of the client and you're trying to process things in terms of theoretical models, and you really can, you know, miss the forest for the trees. So, and I'm terribly guilty of that myself. So I'm keen to learn from you as to how we can sort of step back and get that broader perspective.
Yeah, you say that thing in the book there, Michael, about focus is a key element in what you're talking about.
Yes. There's a couple ways of answering that, Matthew. It's a good question. But first, and why I have such a strong attachment to the hypnosis side of the equation, is because it's so easy to define people's problems as problems of focus. They focus on the unchangeable and hurtful past, when a shift to focusing on the future would be far more productive and far more beneficial. Or they're focused on their feelings when they really should be thinking. Or they're thinking when they should be focused on their feelings, or they're focused on themselves when they should be paying attention to the other significant people in their life, or they're so wrapped up in the other people in their life they neglect themselves. So in many ways, therapy in general, hypnosis in particular, is about how do we shift the person's focus from what is working against them to what will be helpful to them. And that presupposes that therapists have a better than average grasp of where should someone's attention be if they want to accomplish what they say they want to accomplish. And, you know, you look at the incongruities of the therapy field, and I'm trying to correct for many of those. So if what you're trying to do is help somebody build a compelling future, then talking about and analyzing the past isn't going to get you there. It's just not the pathway to follow if this is where you want to end up. And so that's what I mean by the process side of the equation. So that's one part of it, is looking at where is the person's focus and where would it be more beneficial for them to focus to accomplish their goals. And then secondly, when you're conducting the clinical interview with someone, it's so important to have an idea of what does this person want? What are the goals that they have? And how well can I articulate what the steps are to reach that goal? But at the same time, I'm also interested in another parallel process. And that is, when this person has had this problem for years, as is typical of people in therapy, how is it that this person has been living life, watching movies, seeing television programs, reading books, having conversations with friends, watching the news, having experiences, going places, doing things? How do they have all of these experiences and still manage to stay the same? I'm so curious about that process. So that's part of what I am interested in the interview. Not just what does the person want to change, but how do they manage to stay the same?
Yeah, the maintenance.
How does that change with all these new influences coming in all the time? To me, there's a very sharp distinction between what it means to get older and wiser and what it means to just get older.
Yeah, you talk in there about Erickson's comment, you know, what's the basis of lots of problems and things, and his answer was rigidity. And you spend a bit of time looking at that, and that to some extent, is that a part of this aspect? I imagine that is, that we get sort of stuck in stuff.
Yeah, you know, Erickson's one-word answer to what causes people's problems is so deceptively simple because it represents an enormous complexity. When we think about different qualities of rigidity and different dimensions of rigidity, and what does that mean exactly, if not the necessity of people, I don't know who said it, somebody in the human potential movement, that life begins beyond your comfort zone. And I think there's a lot of truth in that until people are willing to step outside the usual, they're not going to discover what their capabilities are. And for me personally, that's one of the most compelling reasons to do hypnosis, that, you know, here's this person who has never experienced hypnosis or anything like it. And then you do a hypnosis session with them where they discover all these abilities and resources they didn't know they had. And how would they know they had those resources if no one ever created a context for them to discover them? And so to create a context where people can discover more about themselves, more about their innate abilities, that to me is the greatest countermeasure to rigidity.
Absolutely. And the book... The book usefully is, and I think it's helpful for people to appreciate before they even go for it, is in two sections. And one is sort of discussing the process, the elements, the reasons behind things. But then you do go into the methods of enabling this and producing this. And one that I immediately jumped to, and you please talk about as many as you want, but building expectancy was the chapter that immediately drew my eye, because you've talked about it and we've talked about it before. So this two parts of the book, what was the thinking with that?
Well, the first part, providing the conceptual framework, getting therapists to think in terms of process is not very easy necessarily. That, you know, therapists have historically keyed in on details and details and details, and who's your second cousin twice removed, and, you know, how many different flavors of ice cream have you tried at 31 flavors, and people get wrapped up in all kinds of things that are just so irrelevant to solving the problem.
Lots of trees.
Yeah, a lot of trees. And so the idea was, okay, here's the conceptual framework, that if you can train yourself to start to think in process terms, then you're going to be far less likely to get lost in the details of what somebody presents to you. You're far less likely to get lost in all of this overpowering wave of empathy that you feel for this person, and you're going to get more focused more quickly on how do we solve the problem here. And, you know, that whole orientation, you know, of being a problem solver. There are therapists that disagree with that. They think that therapy is about psychoeducation, or they think that therapy is about emotional ventilation. But me being a strategic therapist, I am unapologetically goal-oriented, and very simply because every client I've ever treated wanted something to happen, wanted some outcome. And the idea of not thinking in outcome-oriented terms is just alien to me, but it is routine for other people who think in those terms, that the details matter, and they want to, you know, give this person the time to offer all these, to me, irrelevant details. And then the second part of the book is, okay, so plugging that in, what would it look like in terms of actual hypnosis sessions? So before the hypnosis sessions, transcripts, I actually provide session transcripts that are meant to be generic transcripts, things that you would polish and add to if you were working with an individual client in order to tailor it to that individual. But I speak to, if somebody has this issue, here are the different forms it might take so that you don't get fooled by the content, that you understand the underlying process. So I offered 10 different core processes that influence the great majority of human problems. So let's just use as an example, impulsivity. If you ask any therapist, what are the kinds of problems that an impulsive person might experience? You know, how long a list do you want? The impulsivity of abusing alcohol, the impulsivity of having reckless sexual encounters, the impulsivity of quitting a job because you're mad today, even though you need the income badly, the impulsivity of hitting your kid when you're angry about something, the impulsivity of telling your partner that you don't care for them because you're mad at them right now. You look at the range of extraordinary range of problems that arise when somebody acts in an impulsive fashion. And so if you just treat the content of, you know, we're dealing with the having quit the job thing, well, then we're missing the larger clinical picture, which is you'll make consequential decisions impulsively. And it worked against you now by losing your job, but it's going to work against you how many more times in your lifetime if you make decisions that way. So the goal is, how can I help you be far less impulsive, much more thoughtful, much better at predicting consequences instead of thinking that the future is entirely unpredictable? There are a lot of things that are very predictable. You know, you beat your kid, it's not hard to predict this kid's going to have some problems. You call people names, it's not difficult to understand why they don't really want to be around you very much, and on and on and on. So that's just an example. So then if I'm going to teach impulse control, what would that look like in terms of a hypnosis session? So then I provide a detailed full transcript from beginning to middle to end, that if you were going to do a session that revolved around developing impulse control, this is what it would sound like, and use it as a basis.
I think that unpredictability and predictability concept is something that we don't understand, and sort of certainly I've been pushing a lot of complex systems and talking about that as unpredictable. But actually, the thing about complex systems is that they have not necessarily a specific predictability, but they actually are quite predictable, exactly as you say, the way you approach things, the actions you take, the orientations. And so this idea of process-oriented, so an orientation coming in to the therapy is a way of creating a degree of predictability about where the therapy session is going to come out. That's what I'm hearing. You know, if you're just going to let them air emotions, that's what's going to get, and so on and so forth.
That happens to be another one of the process suggestions in the book is building foresight. Building foresight, the ability to extrapolate that how things get from here to here, which means they're likely to get to here. And, you know, that doesn't have to be absolute certainty to be high probability that here's what's going to happen. That if you're going to smoke two packs of cigarettes a day, it's a pretty good prediction that you're going to have some health issues down the line. And, you know, and the problem is how many problems that people have could have been prevented with just this much foresight. And the global pandemic is a perfect example. You know, the world suffering, the number of people killed by this virus, that how much could have been prevented if people hadn't made it political, if they hadn't made it, you know, about convenience and understood what it means to have a health pandemic going on, that we could predict that we were going to have these kinds of issues and that variants were going to develop and that people were going to have difficulty with vaccines and all the kinds of things that are unfortunately all too predictable. But when you have therapists who espouse the philosophy, I mean, I wish I had a dollar for every time I've heard this, the past is gone. The future hasn't happened yet. All there is this moment. And as soon as you adopt that position, you forego your ability to ever be able to make decent predictions. And I think that's a shame.
Right, right. We sort of mentioned it at the beginning. I'd like to reiterate that at this point, that this process orientation, to me, it feels like kind of like a meta framework that you could apply with whatever therapeutic orientation you come from. So how would you address other therapists who don't really consider themselves in the same field as you? How would you address them in terms of this that you're presenting?
I think that if therapists were to task themselves with defining the client's problem in 25 words or less, defining the core therapeutic message that you're trying to get across to this person in 25 words or less, then tasking yourself with, if this is the message I want to give them, how am I going to get that across to them in a practical way? And then it challenges you, how do I take this message and make it understandable and easy to integrate? How do I provide people with experiences that will help them appreciate the value of that message and the skills that go with it? So I think no matter what type of therapist you are, there's a message you want to get across to this client. That if you're a cognitive therapist and you want to say to this person, gee, you engage in a lot of all or none thinking, okay, that's a good observation. Your message in 25 words or less, life isn't black and white, a lot of life is gray. Okay, good message. Now, how do we bring that to life for someone? How do we make it possible for them to move through their day recognizing the gray in the situations they encounter instead of automatically moving them into the realms of black or white? So it's a very practical orientation, so that even if you are philosophically sophisticated as a therapist, how do we make that message practical and easy to integrate? And now we're into a whole different realm of style of communication and way we define the therapeutic relationship.
So I'm hearing a bit of like solution-orientated positioning here.
You know, I mean, it's always interesting to me that when people hear me talk, the people who are solution-oriented say, I hear solution-oriented. The people who are psychodynamic say, I hear psychodynamic. The cognitive folks say, I hear cognitive. You know, I don't classify it, you know. I don't care if we call it solution-oriented or we call it Ralph. What I'm interested in is the process underneath the label. What are we actually doing with someone? And I like the solution orientation. You know, Steve DeShazer was, you know, somebody I used to talk with all the time. But the reality is that there are a lot of different elements to it. There's Erickson's work all over. There's Jay Haley's influence. There's Aaron Beck's influence. I can tell you all the people who have influenced me markedly over the course of my professional lifetime. But to me, it's just about a real simple thing. What am I trying to teach this person, and what's the method I'm going to use to help them learn it?
Okay, so beautiful.
And that's directly related on the individual level to the capacities that they have. We often use musical metaphors here because we're doing it, but ourselves a lot. But if you're going to say someone, you know, improvise some music, well, clearly a jazz musician is going to improvise jazz, and a country musician is going to improvise country, and they're both going to be great bits of music. And and this is the message that I've heard from you for a decade or more.
It's like the great artist Picasso said. Learn the rules like a pro so that you can break them like an artist.
It was so funny. When I was at the Picasso Museum, I remember walking around. I love Picasso and I got some fabulous insights. But I thought, yes, you're good, but yes, you're bad. When I walked around the corner and there were some beautiful, lifelike, almost photographic type of drawings and paintings. And I thought, oh, he can paint. It's like, oh, he can do it properly. but it's exactly that. We learn the technique in order to become the unique the unique expression of, or as Erickson said, you know, that each therapy is a unique experience.
Exactly right.
Michael, this has been a long journey for you. I mean, you've not just written this book out of your thoughts last week. So I wonder if you could share a little bit of the journey. What got you through all the many, many things that you've learned and thought about and all these teachings that got you to here?
I'd say there were two major factors. Let me tell you a background story if I can.
Oh, yeah, great.
When I was an undergraduate student, I was at a university called University of Michigan, very good school, and I was very immersed in the academic experience. I was doing a lot. I was working as a researcher at the Institute for Social Research. I was serving as a TA in a psychopathology course at the graduate level. And I was just immersed in psychology and psychotherapy. And the department that I was in was very, very heavily psychoanalytic. I mean, it was all about Freud all the time. There was very little else. There was one minor wing of behaviorism, but the vast majority of the program was all very psychodynamic. And so from that perspective, everything that you think is of great significance, everything that you think needs to be explored and analyzed, and what it says about your personality and your unconscious dynamics and all of that. And I grew up in a very perfectionistic home where if you did less than perfect, you were punished for it one way or another. So as I was coming into the field of therapy, I was fascinated by it, but I was personally filled with all kinds of self-doubts, you know, that am I smart enough? Am I capable enough? Am I going to be able to do this? I don't think I can. What's wrong with me? I'm always too self-critical. I'm too perfectionistic. And, you know, I'm trying to do all these things to help myself get out of all that and failing miserably. And thinking that, well, maybe I'm just not cut out for this field. Maybe, you know, maybe my self-doubts and self-criticism and perfectionism are too debilitating for me to even think about being a therapist. And fortunately, you know, one of the things about me was I was pretty assertive about seeking out people who were the best people in the field to learn from. And one of those great mentors was one I was talking to once, and I was self-disclosing about all my self-doubts and all my self-criticisms and my crippling perfectionism and all of that. And I told him, I have this voice inside my head all the time that puts me down and says terrible things and makes me feel really bad. And all he said, incredibly casually, was, well, why do you listen to it? And I was, are you kidding me? Why do I listen to it? I mean, that's been my training, is you got to listen to everything and analyze everything. It never occurred to me not to listen to it. I didn't even know that was an option, not to listen to it. And I mean, literally, everything changed almost in that moment. All of a sudden, I realized this doesn't have anything to do with my background, my age, my parents, my social class, my educational level, or gender, none of that. That this was about, here's stuff going on in my head that I'm responding to it as if it's important, and what happens if I reclassify it as not? And just like that. So that's my first direct experience of realizing that none of the content matters. You know, how I got to be perfectionistic and who my parents were and what the interactions were and what they said to me that scarred me and all of that, irrelevant. It was just about, why do you listen to it? And then it was, I don't know how many years later, not a lot of years later, that I went to the first Evolution of Psychotherapy meeting. This was 1985 now. And here you had every therapeutic genius in one place. Mm-hmm. And this was when everybody was still alive, all the pioneers of this field. So you had everybody there. I mean, Virginia Satir was there, Rollo May, Carl Whitaker, Sal Mnuchin, James Masterson, Jay Haley. I mean, on and on and on and on and on. It was just, you know, it was known as the Woodstock of psychotherapy. And all it did was reinforce for me. You walk into this room and here's Aaron Beck talking about how important it is to focus on people's cognitions. Then you walk into a room with Virginia Satir and she's talking about how important it is to connect with people's feelings. Then you walk into a room with Jay Haley and he says you really have to focus on the system and the interpersonal relationships. Then you walk into a room with James Masterson and you have to focus on the individual and the individual psychodynamics. Then you walk into Alexander Lowens and you have to focus on the body. And so here are all these brilliant people coming at the same problems from how many different angles? And that's when it became abundantly clear to me. Everything works, everybody's right, and no one and it's all good. But it's no longer about searching for the truth. It's not about what's correct. It's about what's effective. And the ability to make the transition from being right to being effective, to me, is huge. And so fortunately, I learned that early on, and it gave me the full freedom to stop trying to be correct or perfect and just be good. And I'm not the one who determines that. My client determines that. So,
yeah,
all of that helped.
Isn't that the most powerful thing? The difference between being right and being effective. And it's the thing that isn't addressed, well, not in any of the educational, sort of foundational, everything's about learning to be. Anyway, I won't wax on that because
I agree with you. I think this is a shame that this is the way students are trained, because they come out of these programs thinking that if they do this therapy right, then everything's going to work. And it just doesn't work that way.
Yes, I'm very lovely. John Arden is doing the introduction to our new book, and he addresses this very thing where he had a student or someone coming into the postdoc situation and saying, you know, my plan is to find the theoretical framework that I'm going to base everything around. And he said, well, maybe not. Maybe it's a really good idea to find out the frameworks that you can support a therapeutic and, as you're saying, effective therapeutic approaches.
Yeah.
How about finding the framework that the client's in order to be able to engage?
Yeah.
That's the challenge in all this, is what a difference between bringing the client to your preferred theoretical perspective versus you coming to this client's way of thinking and doing things. So it's all difference in the world. So.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, I learned that in acting school.
Yeah, well, Michael, I am so glad that you've written this book, and I would encourage every therapist to have a read of Process-Orientated Hypnosis, focusing on the forest, not the trees. Michael, is there, just before we leave, is there any final point you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think that... Yeah, the field of therapy is undergoing some pretty radical changes right now that have been forced on us by the pandemic. Mm. And so here is the opportunity for us to rethink many of the things that we have assumed to be true about therapy. Just as a final example, you have people doing therapy by video now, video platforms. And, you know, now we've had over the last year forced on us because of quarantine delivering therapy this way. And people who were absolutely convinced that this was going to diminish the value of therapy, that therapy done this way wasn't going to be nearly as effective as when you're in person. And now all of these studies that show the same thing, that we're not losing a thing by doing it as telehealth, and that, in fact, there are some benefits to it, but that it doesn't reduce the efficiency or the value of the therapy by doing it this way. Now, that's a direct challenge to one of the most basic assumptions about how important it is to be in this relationship in the room and you know, to build that therapeutic alliance. And now we discover that there are other ways of doing that. And I'm hoping that what process-oriented hypnosis will do is invite therapists to re-examine some of their most basic assumptions about how much content they need in order to be able to intervene successfully.
That sounds like a damn fine quote to leave everybody on. I love it. Okay, this is one I think people are going to have to listen to a couple of times.
Michael, it's always such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to do it. It's my pleasure. I appreciate you inviting me to do this and give me a chance to talk about the new book.
Wonderful. And we'll see you as soon as we see you, which is wonderful.
Good. Take care of yourselves, guys.
All right. Bye. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye now.
Love talking to Michael. There it is. Being right or being effective. Making the client come to your thinking, or you taking your thinking and adjusting it to the client. It's what we're trying to explain in our book, that your thinking is enhanced by the knowledge. That's what the science of psychotherapy is all about.
Yeah.
It's to enhance your knowledge so that you have something more to take to the client. So wonderful, wonderful book, I think.
Yeah, great, great resource. And Richard, I don't know, when I was, you know, talking to Michael and I made the comment about, you know, reminds me of some aspects of solution-orientated therapy, what I was trying to say was, you know, there's a positioning here that is orientated toward achieving the goal.
Yeah. But what Michael was saying was quite true is that, and what's beautiful is that all these therapies, solution and CBT and stuff, as he was saying about the conference, they all are just slightly different ways, slightly different facets of the same gem, which are the capacities and the healing, the self-healing capacities of the client. And we're just generating the right part of their own motives. It was great the way you put. And the other thing that, of course, Michael brought up about the online stuff, and we must remind people, because he's associated with that terrific app. Oh, dear, I've forgotten it off the top of my head. But
we can point people to it, yeah.
And we'll point people to that. So that's where people get access connection, immediacy of connection. These are where all these online things are becoming really important. So fabulous. Fabulous stuff. Do you like talking to Michael?
Okay, beautiful. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. And we hope to catch you next time.
Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.